Carter versus Ennis, which I take council are all ready to go at. And the second one is People versus Garrett. Council here and prepare to proceed. Okay. Okay, when you came in, I believe you got some oral argument instructions about our procedures. Do you have any questions about those?
No questions.
Okay, no questions. I think then with that, we can begin with our oral argument. I'd ask you to identify yourself by name and attorney registration number when you come to the podium. And for anyone who's in the audience, and I don't think we have anyone who's in the audience who's not a arguing lawyer, but anyone who shows up, tell them to turn their cell phones and pagers off. I think with that, we can begin.
Thank you.
I'm John Dudgeon, registration number 5732. I represent the appellants, the Innises, that is Norma Innis, Dane Innis, and Richard Innis. Your Honors, we're asking this court today to reverse the trial court and remand for an actual trial and for the taking of actual evidence in the case. Basically, the case is about two families who were neighbors and good friends in Grand Junction. Jewel Noren was the neighbor to the Innises, owned property that was basically a part-time residence. He lived in Carson City, Nevada, and was at this property in Grand Junction maybe at the most 4 to 6 weeks a year. Jewel Noren wanted to make a gift of this property to the Innises for several reasons. The Innises, for their part, wanted to try to pay Mr. Noren and offered to pay him with a promissory note, which we think he uniformly rejected. He didn't want to be paid. The trial court decided the case on summary judgment without a hearing.
Counsel, with regard to the note, if excuse me interrupting, you say he did accept the note, though, didn't he? It was presented to him. He had it in his effects when he died. He never canceled it. He never gave it back. But never threw it away.
I suppose the question is whether he actually accepted the promissory note, Your Honor. There's no question the note was delivered to him along with other documents. We contend that he never did accept it. And in fact, as the court's aware, nothing happened on this for about a year and a half after the initial delivery of the documents to Mr. Noren.
How can you say he didn't accept it if it was delivered to him, he kept it, he didn't destroy it, he didn't return it? It sounds to me like he accepted it.
Well, Your Honor,
if I gave you a $10 bill and you took it and put it in your pocket, wouldn't that be an acceptance?
I suppose it would, Your Honor, but if I delivered something to you on your desk that was offensive to you and you opted not to do anything with it, does that mean you accepted it? I don't think so.
Let me ask you this, counsel. Didn't he sign a agreement that referenced this promissory note?
He did eventually sign an agreement that did reference the note, Your Honor.
Then, you know, that plus the other circumstances that Judge Miller was alluded to doesn't mean he accepted the note?
It's our contention, Your Honor, and this was the evidence that was offered by the Innises, not only through their depositions, but also through an affidavit of one of the neighbors of Mr. Noren, Mr. Hal Richardson in Carson City, Nevada, that he had always said he wanted to give this property to the Innises. And he told the Innises he didn't want any payment for it. That's the evidence that has been presented, and that's the evidence that was excluded, Your Honor, because of the way the trial court decided this case.
Let me ask just one other question about the acceptance, and I'll let you move on. That wasn't raised in the trial court, was it, the fact that there has been no acceptance?
No, Your Honor, that was not raised in the trial court, but we think that the evidence that was offered by the Innises in effect raised the question, because the Innises had consistently stated in their depositions and in any evidence that was presented, which unfortunately wasn't in testimony, that Mr. Noren didn't want the note, he didn't accept it, he disclaimed essentially any interest in receiving any payment for that property. He wanted the property to go to the Innises.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. As we've indicated, The decision was made by the trial court on summary judgment, and the trial court, on its own initiative, classified the Innes' defense, which was waiver, as instead one of renunciation. This was done without having been raised by any of the parties in the trial court. The trial court came up with this idea on its own and based apparently on its own research. The consequence of having classified the defense erroneously as one of renunciation was that the trial court then excluded the Innes' tendered evidence, which would show waiver. This was parole evidence. The court ruled under the statute that applied, the UCC statute that applies to renunciation, that parole evidence was not admissible because the statute required any evidence of renunciation to be either in writing or to be a definitive act such as redelivery or destruction of the document.
Yeah, your adversary indicates that there's no difference between renunciation and waiver. Is that clear from the UCC?
We think that that's not a correct position, Your Honor. We think that if you look at a dictionary definition of them, the dictionary definition is very similar. But the application and the test to be examined under each of them is entirely different. Renunciation, as we've indicated and as the statute states, requires a written document or some definitive act such as destruction. Waiver, on the other hand, can be proven by parole. It can also be proven by inference, by a party's course of conduct, and does not require a written document. And that is the evidence that unfortunately was excluded by the trial court in its summary judgment because of its reliance on the definition or on the statute outlining renunciation, which we think was totally an error. And in fact, there are several Colorado cases that we've mentioned in our brief, principally Ibrahimi versus E.F. Hutton. There's also Adams versus White, and there are others that discuss the defense of renunciation. And those cases indicate that the renunciation definition and test will apply if that's the defense that is raised. However, if that's not the defense that is raised, then it will not apply. But that's precisely what happened in this case.
So can you address the question of whether or not waiver is included within the statutory definition of renunciation? Did the legislature intend to make renunciation the only way for someone to give up their rights under a negotiable instrument? Or does waiver exist outside the statute?
Your Honor, we believe waiver does exist outside the statute, and the case law would tend to indicate that. The case law already talks about situations where there's a question of whether it's renunciation or whether it's waiver, and indicating that if renunciation is the defense that is presented, then that's how the decision will be made. However, if the parties do not raise the issue of renunciation, then that test is not to be applied.
Are all these case law that would
demonstrate that the legislature intended these two to overlap?
All these cases, UCC cases, the ones you're referring to, the ones that say, well, if you don't plead renunciation, waiver applies, are they UCC cases?
No, Your Honor, those are not specifically UCC cases.
I think Judge Nieto was asking, under the UCC, is there any intent, you know, by the legislature indicated that for negotiable instruments, renunciation is the defense, not waiver?
I don't think there's any indication in the statute itself or in the cases. I have not found any case that would offer that as a proposition. In fact, the cases that we have cited are all cases that were decided subsequent to the existence of the renunciation statute, but which do not indicate that there is a complete overlap or a duplication or a replacement, as I think maybe Your Honor was indicating, of the renunciation test by a statutory, I'm sorry, by the waiver test by a statutory renunciation test.
I don't believe that's the case, and there's no evidence that I have seen that would indicate it.
Counsel, could you explain to us why we should consider statements by the decedent in connection with the motion for summary judgment?
Well, Your Honor, are you referring to the parole evidence rule?
I was thinking the dead man's statute. The dead man's statute.
Well, we believe that the statements made by Jewel Noren are definitely admissible. The dead man statute does not apply in this case. In fact, the trial court ruled that the dead man statute did not apply. And that ruling has not been appealed. It's essentially the rule of the case, and we think that the trial court was correct in that decision. The dead man statute is, in its current form, is a statute of inclusion rather than exclusion, which is what the previous statute was. That statute was repealed and reenacted, I believe, in 2002. I could find no subsequent cases that have interpreted the new statute. All of the cases we have that I've seen on the dead man statute are pre the 2002 repeal and reenactment.
Preceding the section that immediately precedes the dead man statute states that testimony of any person is competent except as provided in subsections 102 through, I think it's 108. So isn't that to suggest that the legislature intends that section 102, the dead man statute, is intended to be a preclude certain evidence? I mean, by its terms, it obviously does, doesn't it?
Your Honor, we do not believe that that is the situation, and of course the trial court has ruled on that, indicating that it was a statute as it stands in its current form of inclusion rather than exclusion. In addition to that, we would also suggest that the plaintiff has raised the question of parole evidence rule, which is very similar to the dead man statute. That also was essentially ruled against by the trial court. And certainly in those situations, when you're looking at parole evidence, there are many exceptions to those rules, including statements against pecuniary interest that would indicate that the evidence should be admissible here.
Well, that's a hearsay issue, I think. With regard to parole evidence, does parole evidence rule apply to evidence that relates to things that happen after the instrument is executed and signed, after a contract is reached?
I think that's talking mostly about contemporaneous statements.
That's my understanding as well.
Is that so recall?
So I don't disagree necessarily the parole evidence rule doesn't apply.
But in this case, we had statements both before and at the time and subsequent to the date of the promissory note.
That's good. I'm glad you made that distinction, counsel, because under the parole evidence rule, statements before and statements made at the time of the transaction can't be used to contradict the otherwise unambiguous terms of the agreement, can they?
Well, and we are not saying in this case that those statements contradict the terms of the instrument, Your Honor. What we are saying is that it's a waiver of the instrument.
But does a waiver occur after the instrument goes into effect?
Typically, the waiver occurs afterwards.
So wouldn't it be the statements made by the decedent after this agreement had supposedly been entered into?
Well, that would be true, Your Honor, and the defense of estoppel was also raised in the pleadings in this case, although we haven't made an issue of it on this appeal, but we think that the defense also would probably apply because that would not distinguish between statements before, during, or after the execution of the instrument. Essentially, Your Honor, we believe that what has happened in this case is that the trial court inadvisably mischaracterized the defense raised by the Innises. Having mischaracterized it, then used the incorrect burden to exclude evidence that should have been accepted, and finally that the court ignored the basic burdens under summary judgment, which as this court is well aware, is a heavy burden. All inferences must be made in favor of the non-moving party. All doubts resolved against the movement and waiver is clearly an issue of fact, and it's error for the court to decide that as a matter of law. At this point, I'd like to reserve any time I have left.
I'll see you have about half a minute left.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Keith Boughton, number 1602. Number 12060. I'm the attorney for Alan Glover. He was identified as a personal representative in the caption. However, in the court below, he was identified as a special administrator, and to the extent that makes any difference, I wanted to bring that to your attention. It's our position, the plaintiff, the appellee's position, that the critical issue is the one that the court has focused on in its questioning. Is there a difference between renunciation and waiver?
Let me go back to the issue I think you just introduced. He's a special administrator. To the extent that makes a difference, what's a special administrator?
Mr. Glover is an elected official in Carson City, Nevada. Originally, there was a personal representative who was a family member. However, he moved out of the state of Nevada. That disqualified him from further action as a personal representative, and therefore, no one could serve in the state of Nevada as a personal representative under the will being probated there. As a result, the court appointed the public administrator to step in and have the same roles. He is the same kind of fiduciary, and this particular case is being formally administered in Nevada. Again, returning to the issue that I believe is the central one is the difference between renunciation and waiver, and it was the position that I advanced in the brief that it's a distinction, if there is any, without a difference. However, I do think that upon reflection, a renunciation is a creature of statute of section 43604. Whereas waiver has a large body of common law that supports it. And I concur with opposing counsel that waiver, as it's articulated in the common law, can include intent to be inferred from evidence. However, the case law that has developed in interpreting renunciation under the statute, in my view, compels a conclusion that waiver, as it relates to a negotiable instrument like this, has been gutted as a defense.
And so what about section, I think it's 43601 of the UCC, which says that an obligation to pay can be discharged as stated in the UCC or by any act or agreement that would discharge under a simple contract? I mean, doesn't that, and I think there's another provision in the UCC in the beginning which says that all principles of law and equity supplement the UCC unless specifically displaced. Doesn't that reflect an intent by the legislature to retain common law concepts of waiver?
It may well have. However, the case of Metro National Bank versus Roe, cited in the briefs, indicate that testimony of an oral release was insufficient as a matter of law to establish that a payee had released the maker of his liability on the promissory note. Now, if an oral release is, as a matter of law, as construed by the Court of Appeals in that 1983 case, then it would seem that that statute you have cited must be read in conjunction with the case law that has construed 43609.
How does the Metro case square with the Ebrahimi case, which came out just the opposite and was subsequently decided?
The Ebrahimi case involved a broker who did not have, as I understood the case and I read it, my memory is not perfect, he had allegedly waived his principal's right to recover interest. And it was independently backed up by evidence in his own records that when the obligor made payments, he applied them 100% to the principal and not to the interest. But he sure as heck did not waive the obligation under the note. So this was a brokerage account kind of action rather than a promissory note to enforce the whole thing and waive the whole thing.
In Ebrahimi, I think the court specifically pointed out that there was no renunciation defense, only a waiver defense.
And it was a waiver to a component of it, and I puzzled over that last night. How do you waive a part of something? Isn't it a complete defense or is it not? Evidently, as it was postured in the decision-making process, the waiver issue was, I don't have to pay interest. My broker waived any obligation to pay that. I was doing my best to pay the principal. In reality, do you have any compelling evidence that would substantiate that? Yes, look at my broker's own records. When I made a payment, he didn't use the American rule and apply it to the interest first. He applied it to the principal first. Well, now that's a historical collection of facts. That is something that would tend to indicate a novation or some kind of an agreement was made afterward that modified it. That is a new agreement. But it is not a waiver of the entire obligation to pay the note, where they would say, well, you applied all of these payments only to the promissory note without applying it to the principal. Let's rip the whole thing up. Now, it seems to have been a distinction that they made that I cannot find you any finer than that.
And the court didn't talk about it as breaking down a distinction between a partial waiver and a complete waiver, did it?
It did not. I did that myself.
Okay.
There's no question.
Sir, can you point to anything in the statute that would justify your interpretation of the Ebrahimi decision? That the statute somehow says you could waive part, but you can only renounce all by using the statutory process?
No, I cannot.
It's given the sections of the UCC that Judge Miller quoted to you, how does that defense not survive?
I believe that it does not survive in view of the rationale in the Metro National Bank case, if I'm remembering my cases correctly. I mean, the old stuff they teach you in law school about the camel's nose and the tent, if you are going to have an entire collection of promissory notes that can be challenged by somebody saying, wait a minute, I've got some oral evidence that would indicate that maybe we reached a subsequent agreement that allowed us to waive this, and we'd really like to have every one of these promissory notes balled up in the trial courts while you figure that out. That, there's nothing to substantiate that in the record right now or in the case law. Every single renunciation case involves promissory notes. The waiver issue, if you look at all of the cases, including the ones that my adversary cited in his supplemental authorities, they relate to deeds, they relate to contracts, but the negotiable instruments were a peculiar feature. And if you were going to create a brand new defense, dear lender, I don't have to pay you because we had an oral agreement. Remember that? Well, you might not because you fired that guy. This is not something, and I think that when testimony of an oral release is insufficient as a matter of law, and that case has not been overturned, that this has been given some thought and has been decided, and that precedent should be binding. I would also like to make the point that the term waiver in the renunciation statute, that word is not there, as near as I can tell. But all the others are release, discharge, cancellation. If you are going to let somebody off the hook that they placed themselves on when they signed a document, you need to have some kind of objective, demonstrable indication that the guy who had the opportunity to enforce that let them off the hook. Not some dead guy's recollection or some friend who signed an affidavit says, you know, I lived with him for a long time and I seem to recall I might have seen a document where he went.
What if this weren't negotiable instruments? What if this were just another type of written instrument, just a regular contract? Would your argument be the same?
No, I'm inclined to concede that. I'm inclined.
But would it make sense in that context to say, well, you know, without evidence substantiating, we still should be able to hear the testimony from people about oral releases?
The parole evidence rule is not really an evidence rule. It's a substantive rule of the law of contracts. And it says that you can't use, where there's an unambiguous contract or instrument or writing, you can't use statements made, even contemporaneous or prior, to come in and modify or change the entire agreement. So we know that if we're calling this the law of evidence, when in fact, in my view, it's a law of contracts, you can't bring in parole evidence to modify anything. Now, if you have a novation, if you've got a substantive agreement that amounts to a waiver, maybe you can have some evidence like that. But that is not the question that's being addressed here. The question is, you've got a negotiable instrument. It's not ambiguous. And it doesn't seem to come under the Telluride issue where you can Well, I'm not sure it's ambiguous. Let's take a look at the facts and see if we can make it ambiguous and then discern what ambiguity we need to correct.
I thought opposing counsel suggested there is some evidence of subsequent statements or actions that would support even the novation theory that you just indicated.
There is efforts in the record that's been presented below where they brought in their self-serving hearsay of what they thought this dead man said. So to the extent that there was a proffer of evidence, I will concur that there is something in the record that could indicate maybe that happened. Now, in summary judgment proceedings, you have to bring admissible evidence in because there's no real point to say, well, you might have some. Let's see if you can get through the hoops and trial.
And why is it inadmissible now?
Well, there's several reasons. First is the parole evidence rule, but that doesn't have anything to do with your novation.
That's right. Thank you.
Has to do with just flat hearsay. These are out-of-court statements being made someplace else. Nevada, maybe they're made in Colorado. We don't even know exactly where the statements were made.
Aren't they statements against interest? Wouldn't they be admissible under the hearsay rules?
Well, if so, they are not then admissible under the dead man statute.
Okay.
So we've got the dead man statute keeping it out because it is a statement that cannot be cross-examined by us, and the statement is being made by a person who is dead. And what they have confused in the dead man statute is, I know he's dead, but we've got our own statement of what he said. And that, they need to get the dead man statement in, not their own statement, saying, well, I think that he intended to waive it. Where did they say, in unambiguous terms, he used these words, he said this, it certainly wasn't under oath, so it doesn't fall under that exception to the hearsay rule. Where is the other material corroboration that would allow it to fall under the exception to the dead man's statute? Where is it?
The counsel, did the trial court ever rule on that question of whether or not there was corroboration sufficient to bring it within the exceptions in the dead man's statute?
If he did, I am unaware of it and will not represent that he did.
Well, then if he doesn't answer that question, how can he find that to be inadmissible evidence if he doesn't analyze the dead man statute in that regard?
Because he did exactly what Mr. Dudgeon, my adversary, said he did. He analyzed it under renunciation, finding that was sufficient to uphold his ruling that any oral argument, any oral statement would be insufficient to waive it. Why do you need to get to the next issue when the resolution of the case is dispositive? It's just, that's why he wouldn't have gotten to it, at least if I had been in his robes, that's why I wouldn't have done it. I have a lot more I can say, but I sense that this is the central feature of this case, is the renunciation and waiver, and whether an opinion is going to be issuing from this court that would permit negotiable instruments to be challenged by clever lawyers like myself and Mr. Dudgeon throughout the entire state on whether there is some subsequent statement made by a dead man that can somehow survive parole evidence, hearsay, the dead man statute, and a non-ambiguous note that can allow you to end up forcing judges to have hearings on cases when there's a statute that clearly reflects the intent of the legislature, that if there's going to be a renunciation, you got to have more than echoes of words that nobody wrote down. I have nothing more to add at this time.
I don't have enough time to address very much of what has gone on, but let me suggest that the case of Metro versus Roe, which was cited by the trial court and was mentioned by counsel, did not apply in this particular case. That was a situation where there was evidence of an oral release that was declared to be not admissible. The case really supports us because it indicated that evidence would be admissible if it was a defense to the entire obligation. And I think there's been some differentiation among the cases as to whether a defense is a partial defense, and in one situation it was an interest issue as opposed to a defense to the entire case.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
I want to thank both counsel for their arguments. I want to thank both counsel for their candor. Found it refreshing. And case will stand submitted. The opinion will issue in due course. The bailiff will announce a recess, a small recess, while we change the composition of the court for the next oral argument. Thank you.